Welcome to another episode of Science to Suits. We are in our ongoing series of walking through the basics of web science entrepreneurship with a focus on student founders. Today, we discuss intellectual property, and we welcome our guest, Vivian Martin from the Penn Center for Innovation. At the PCI, Vivian is currently the director of the licensing group for the Perelman School of Medicine. Vivian, thank you very much for joining us today. To start us off, can you provide an overview of your background?
Hi, Jared. Hi, Dan. Thank you for inviting me. Sure. Vivian Martin, I got my PhD in France in cellular and molecular and cellular pharmacology and came here at Penn to do a postdoc in the Department of Pharmacology. I've been doing tech transfer in a university setting for now about 20 years. Happy to answer any question and provide any feedback as you see fit.
Great. Thank you, Vivian. To start off with the basics here, can you just provide an overview of what IP protection really means? Why does IP need to be protected?
So intellectual property covers different type of asset, right? It covers trade secret, trademark, patent, and copyright. So trade secret in an academic setting doesn't really exist because we publish. That's the core of what we do. So trade secret is not really an asset. Copyright is really what we write. It's copyrighted at a time. You could protect it with the library, registering the copyright at the Library of Congress if you consider that you want to sue somebody for infringement. And trademark, it's really more for commercial entities, but it can have value. I mean, you look at Apple, you look at Microsoft, those have trademarks and it has a cachet. That's where the value is. And you want to protect it because you want to basically prevent others from using it and confusing your business with others. Patent and patent is really what a lot of people consider as being intellectual property. And you file for intellectual property and patent and try to get an issued patent to prevent others from practicing your technology. It doesn't give you the right to practice. It enables you to prevent others from practicing your technology. So you develop a molecule, it's new, novel, useful. You file for a patent application, you get patent issued. Then the Merck of the world, if they are actually developing and commercializing that molecule, will need to get a license from you, or you're going to be able to sue them for practicing your technology. So what it enables investors to do or company is invest in the development of a technology, and if it's in life science, it's millions and millions and millions of dollars, and have the security that nobody else is going to practice and do the same thing or compete with you. And patent, an issued patent, is a tool to prevent or sue others that would do the same thing as you have issued in a patent application, in a patent.
Got it. Yeah.
Does that?
No, yeah, thank you. That definitely provides a lot of insight. And I'm a little bit curious because you mentioned like an Apple and Microsoft. And I think many people, when they think of copyright or trademarks or intellectual property, they think of those kind of private businesses. So can you give us a little bit of insight into what's the role of like a tech transfer office within the academic center? Think like, of course, there's a lot of research going on at these academic centers, but what is that? What is the main function of that tech transfer, say, at a place like Penn?
Sure. That's a question that could take a few hours to answer, but in a short, so for innovation to really be transferred outside and be developed, it needs to be investable. And to be investable, it needs to be protected like any other businesses. They will want to invest only and if they have an intellectual property protection that is going to protect their investment. That's the basis. So Penn, like any other university, is, I would say, selectively filing for patent application on certain technology to enable, hopefully, a third party to take that asset innovation and develop it into a product or bring it to market. So that if I have a technology and there's no patent protection, ultimately I'm going to publish and anyone and everyone at some point is going to be able to practice it as they want. So it's losing its value as a potential product to be developed and brought to the market.
So like me personally, for example, I definitely did not read thoroughly enough the IP policy for graduate students when, you know, first year at Penn. And I don't think I'm alone in that. So can you help explain how the policy affects graduate students, affects researchers? Does it affect us differently? What's the framework around that, just so we have a little bit better understanding?
It's an excellent question. And it's a question I think that a lot of people, whether they're grad student, they're trainee, or even employees, need to be aware of. Wherever you go, your employer is going to ask you to agree to certain terms. One of those terms is who owns or which entity owns any innovation, any IP that you're going to generate. And here, when I say IP, is copyright, research tool, anything patentable matter. It's anything that falls under IP. As far as I know, the employers, no matter who they are actually getting ownership of that intellectual property. With that said, there's the exception for the student. Depending at what point they are in their academic track, if you're a grad student receiving a stipend working in a lab, you have to assign. If you're an undergrad paying your own way, going to learn, whatever you generate is yours. A faculty is going to also assign, but a faculty is a researcher. I, being employed at the time of signing my employment, I also assign everything. I'm a staff, so I do not have the same rights under a staff versus a faculty or a grad student. You would be considered as part as treated under the patent policy as a staff. What does that mean? The patent policy in most universities states that while the university owns whatever you generate, if there is commercialization of that asset, revenue generated, the inventors or contributors are going to receive a share of those revenue. As a staff, I'm work for hire, so nothing goes back to me. So it's important to understand that there's that assignment, but as an inventor, you have a voice to basically request that asset be developed in one way versus the other. If you're going to, let's say, get your PhD in 6 months, you're still continuing the project and gathering additional data. Your paper is not going to come out until you finish your grad. We may decide to file. You may actually already be thinking of a plan to develop that technology and spin it out in a company. If that's really, really what you want and all the inventors on board, even though maybe the tech transfer may think that the licensing may be a better path, directly licensing directly to an existing company, the role you can have is it's just being pretty proactive and saying, I think this, I want to take this as an asset from a company. The company's form, the company license the asset in your company, and you can develop it as you wish. So as a student or as an employee staff, faculty, being the expert, you have a lot to say in what are the next step in the development of the technology.
Okay, so definitely a perk of being a student or a researcher.
So we've heard about how important it is to protect IP so that it could be investable. So thinking through the whole IP process then, at the very start, so at what point should students think about disclosing their technology when doing their research?
So I would say the earlier the better, however, not too early. If you have an idea and not much data confirming the idea, you may want to wait. With a caveat though, if you want to disclose your idea in an abstract, and that abstract is going to be published, you may want to talk to the tech transfer office first to figure out what is the timing between the abstract being published, you gathering data, and whether we want to file IP before the publication of the abstract and you gathering data. So if you go into the ACR, usually you submit abstract probably 6 or 9 months before. The abstract are going to be published at least a month before the meeting. So if you have an idea submitted and it's really laid out in the abstract, normally the submission is confidential. However, during those 8 months, you develop data. During those 8 months, you come to us and say, hey, here's my idea. Here are the data. What about filing IP? Does it make sense? We have that conversation. And if everybody is on board and we decide to file, the filing will take place before the abstract is published. So to keep the patentability of an invention, it needs to be novel EI, not published anywhere, so that you keep potentially the ability to seek patent protection worldwide. So that would be, I would say the earlier the better. We do often have faculty coming to us and say, hey, look at this paper. This is fantastic. I totally forgot, but can we file for IP on this? Usually it's too late to obtain, for example, European rights. We can still seek US rights, but US rights, depending on what it is, it's 40% of the market. So that may be too limited. But here again, in the decision, if it's something that is revolutionary or it could have an impact, but there's potential for additional improvement that could be patentable, then we can put a stick in the ground, only have a US right, hoping that to work with you on improvement to file other patent application, which will enable to provide worldwide protection.
What are some of those points of no return? So an abstract being published publicly, is it just generally where you've disclosed your new technology, your new idea to a general audience? What are like some examples that, you know, there's no going back?
Presenting in an open forum your work as a grad student. So when you defend, it's an open forum, it's a public disclosure. Don't forget your thesis is going to be registered and then made available. Mm. So that's super important. So papers, if you go and present, so as a grad student, you may decide you want to go to industry after, right? You're going to present to your potential next employee, right? And you present data. This is a public disclosure. You're going to scientific meeting, a poster is a public disclosure. So now there's nuances. If you submit an abstract and you're very general and you say, and your discovery is a new molecule, you could say development of new molecule targeting a new, I don't know, new GPCR, and it kills resistant BRCA1, BRCA2 mutation in breast cancer. If the molecule is the invention, you haven't disclosed the structure, you still have the ability to protect that. So the public disclosure, if it gives out the core of what the invention and the patentable matter is, usually you lose it. Or if you have a device and start using it commercially, after a year, you lose it. You lose the ability to file for IP.
Okay. Yeah. So be cautious. And I think you mentioned like a market share or like the US being 40% of the market. And so it might not be worth it to patent something. So I'm curious what goes into that kind of calculation for you and the tech transfer office. What makes something worth it? What goes into that diligence to determine the yes or no?
One point is filing IP, filing a patent application and prosecuting it can be very expensive. It's probably $30,000-$50,000 to get at the lowest, very conservative, to get a US patent issued. If it's chemical matters, it can be 100K easily. If you go worldwide, Europe, Canada, Australia, China, Japan, between the prosecution, the annuities, the translational fees, you reach $500,000 in no time. So it's super expensive. It's not a goal on its own. And having a patent is great to have that on your resume, but my take is, so what? What is the product? What is your impact in the world? We consider an innovation and looking at what is the product? What is the pros of this product? Is it better? Cheaper is not an argument in the market. Are the patients more receptive? Have they less side effect? Are they basically going to 100% recovery without secondary effect? Or are they going to 50% of recovery, but they don't have any side effects? Maybe that's your key. Maybe it's a device that saves 70% of the surgeon time. So it depends. Like if you tell me this is a new surgical method, it's very difficult. It's not predictable. If it's a new gadget, it's useful, it's convenient, but only researchers are going to use it. It really depends if it's a me too, if it's only for the US, if you can enforce AI, can you police it? AI, can you detect anyone using the technology? If you can't, then is it worth patenting? Let's take a research tool. Let's take mouse models. Those are super useful. But don't forget, you can obtain most of them on JAX for pretty reasonable price. If you get patent cost of 50, 75K, the question is, are you going to recover those patent expenses? Probably not. So you can distribute and license for reasonable fee those research tools. You don't need to file IP for it. The other very, I would say, polemic or controversial is, do we file IP on software? There's people like it's not useful. Some are like, yeah, this is great. And really it depends what it is. And it depends what your commercial strategy is going to be. If your company is going to partially be based on the software, you can think of filing a patent application as a foundation and a tool to attract investors, knowing that on the long term, that may not be as useful as you think. Maybe it will be because the strategy can change, but it may not be as useful as you originally thought. But it provides a certain level of comfort for investors when you have that IP patent application, which hopefully will be issued, and it's a tool to kind of police and protect your business.
Okay. At what point is a technology, and I'm using air quotes, protected? So at what point is it safe? And then once that milestone has been reached, are there any next steps that you have to, for lack of a better term, do maintenance on your IP? Is there anything there?
It's a long process. So you file, let's say in the US, we traditionally file what we call a provisional patent application. It's 1 year during which you can add data and modify a little bit the patent application. And that 1 year, you file full-blown US patent application or a PCT, which will give you the ability to file broadly worldwide. Once you reach that stage, you have communication from the patent office, and the attorney prosecuting is going to issue some reports and then examine and say, this is not patentable because it's not novel over this, it's not novel, it's obvious over 300 publication. And so there's going to be a back and forth in with the patent attorney and the USPTO. With that said, you as an inventor or the tech transfer office don't stop managing. There's two things that happen. We seek your feedback to answer the examiner's question or argument. At the same time, we need to find a home for that technology. And if the home is a startup, the entrepreneur needs to be identified. Maybe it's you. A business plan needs to be done. At that point, it's safe to talk to others and socialize the ideas, socialize your plans. And when you, when I say socialize, you basically talk to potential investors or entrepreneurs in your inner circle to get feedback as to, are you totally off? Are you on the right direction? Do you think that market is the best one? Or should I take that first indication and then the second and then the third? And doing that, it's going to shape your business plan.
And for clarity, this is all after you've filed with the U.S. Patent Office after the provisional.
Yes.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Yes. And then you can form your company and then raise money. You won't be able to raise money until you get a license to that intellectual property. So the company would enter into a license with the university to get rights to that intellectual property. It's not sequential because you need to keep in mind that in the US, you may not get an issued patent after 6 years. And you cannot stay still and not have the technology developed during 6 years because you have 20 years of coverage during the patent life. And it's 20 years starting from the filing, the full-blown application filing. So if you were to wait until issuance, you're losing quite a bit. And a therapeutic takes between, if you have a breakthrough, between 7 years, maybe less, depending if it's a breakthrough or fine. So really, it doesn't leave you much to actually have a product and generate sort of revenue. So that's why you need to start as early as possible your startup and developing the technology. Is it? It's for mouse model, getting data, bigger animals, and then tox, ADME, and so on. It's really a parallel process. And even if you are part of the company, you'll still be involved in the prosecution because it's going to be your product and you may actually be even more aware of the nuances of the product to be able to respond to the examiner. So the university is in constant contact with counsel from the company. And so the claims of the patent are shaped so that the product is covered. But also, I would say no mistakes are done during the prosecution, which could damage later some other strategies.
So you said it may take up 6 years to finally get that patent. Do you, if you don't get the patent, do you know earlier or do you also have to wait 6 years to know that it's a no?
No, you have to wait. So it can be.
Because that seems quite
long,
not productive for business.
It is unproductive. And yet the USPTO is better now. I have cases where we filed and I don't think we receive anything from the USPTO until 4 years down the road afterwards. There's a flip side of it, right? The flip side of it is during that 4 years, it's a stalemate, right? Which means you don't have to pay the patent office or your counsel to do correspondence, draft argument, and so on. But during that time, you're developing your technology. You could probably be at a point where you realize this is not what I thought it was. It has too much toxicity. It cannot be manufactured large scale, whatever it is. So you can actually get to a no decision early, and then you haven't spent much money. That's the flip coin I like to point out. It's not the ideal, of course.
And so Vivian, then, like you were mentioning, is the goal is to spin out a company based on the technology, based on an idea. What are then some of the, I guess, the ongoing strategic considerations then revolving around that intellectual property as, for example, the spin-out grows and you develop that technology? So you mentioned like having a good communication with the original TTO that's necessary, monitoring the status of the patent, but what other types of ongoing strategic considerations need to be made?
I mean, as a business, you're going to generate new data. You're going to generate maybe a new composition of matter. You may generate a software algorithm. So as a startup, you'll have to be aware of what is new that could potentially be valuable and patentable and predictable. That could be But Nat said that we'll have 20 years. So you 3 years in your startup and you have a new series of molecules. Maybe filing is a good idea. You don't know yet whether those compounds are going to be the one you're going to move forward versus the other one, but it could be, you don't know. So 3 years different from the original IP could actually make a huge difference once you're in the market, right? So you constantly as a startup need to look at not publishing your discoveries, right? And assessing, and you work very early on with a patent attorney that you hire. Early on as a startup, you get a patent attorney, you get somebody who does your finance because this is not something that nobody of any grad school is training. And you get insurance. Those are super important things. Once you get the technology moving forward, your patent counsel needs to be aware of the new discovery and advise you as to whether filing is a good strategy, not a good strategy, and why, and so on. Because it's going to be costly. As an early stage company, you don't necessarily have a lot of money. But it could be money well spent, depending on what it is. So it's a constant discussion and evaluation so that, one, you're not letting value go out of the door. You're building your future, and you may make a decision not to move forward, keep certain things secret, and move that way. If you develop a new manufacturing process, for instance, usually they are kept secret, because a patent application is published 18 months from filing. And that's part of the constitution. Providing you the right to have exclude others from practicing is the quid pro quo is you have to publish the best mode so that others can build on it. So manufacturing processes, you keep, and your attorney should tell you that, keep it secret, which means your employees, maybe if there's two or three of them, have to keep that secret as well. The strategy, and if you have a CRO working with you, you have to be careful as to what you disclose to that CRO and have the appropriate agreement in place. It evolves. It's a parallel process with the university. But as an entity, a spin-out is on its own developing its IP.
So at what point from a legal perspective or on paper perspective is the inventorship determined? Is it when you file that disclosure form and you say, you know, my thesis mentor and I split this 50-50? Or is it later? When does that get really hammered down?
It gets hammered down on multiple steps. One piece of knowledge that everyone needs to keep in mind is that if the inventorship on a patent, on an issued patent, is not correct, it can be grounds for invalidation. So with that said, at the time of disclosure to the office, you really list those you think are inventors. Since it's an illegal determination, it's very difficult sometimes to say, well, this person only did the experiment, I had the idea, oh, he's my mentor, really, but I had the idea and I did everything. You may be the sole inventor. You can put a note and say, I'd like to discuss inventorship. Before we file, and we know that if we've been alerted, we know that inventorship needs to be discussed, then the attorney is going to do an interview of all the people in the listed and even ask questions to define, well, are the people listed inventors or are they only technical contributors? And sometimes it can be surprising. There's a collaborator that will be put in that was not considered as an inventor at first. Sometimes the student alone is going to be an inventor. It's a legal determination, but when an attorney is doing that determination, it's a easier way to manage the news. And also at the time of issuance, the application may have 20 claims. At the time of issuance, you may only have one claim. And that one claim may actually be only the results of one of the inventor. Sometimes an inventorship can be performed at the time of issuance. for us in the academic environment, if we license the technology early on, we usually don't do it at the time of issuance unless somebody is raising an issue. As soon as they have money that could be coming.
Yeah, things get interesting.
that's a nice way to put it, yeah.
Vivian, posing a situation here, I would like to see if it's possible, but say like a student comes up with an idea, technology, and that student thinks that this idea is really great. It matches and meets a clinical need very well, that there could be a potentially a really strong and good market for it, but it might not pass some of the criteria that the TTO or the patent office is looking for. Maybe it's not novel enough. Maybe it was publicly disclosed already. And so in one of those steps, the IP was not filed or the patent was not issued. Is that a fair situation to have, firstly? Can that happen? And then if so, is that it for the student's goal to commercialize their idea? Or otherwise, could there be strategies or considerations to really work around that?
These scenarios happen very frequently. I got a call from a student. I have a super great idea. It's a repurposing of an already existing drug. I don't know if it's patentable. Let's assume it's not patentable. We decide not to file. The student, if he is a grad student and his idea is hands, the student can ask for a return. And then there's a process where we return the invention. There's a letter and everything, and the student can go on their own. That said, if any future development of that idea that's done in the lab is going to be pen owned, right? So the student or the person needs to be aware of that. Let's take that example, repurposing of a drug. It's very, very difficult to find a partner or to find investors who want to invest unless the data are just like you cure something in no time. The thing is, IP is not necessarily the sole way of getting exclusivity. So let's say your idea is tremendous, you have amazing data, but the IP is like, it's unlikely feasible. If it's an orphan disease, you can leverage that and say, hey, I can develop this based on the fact that I'm going to get 12 years exclusivity on the market, as 7 in Europe, 7 or 8. So you have some exclusivity on the market for orphan designation. If it's not patentable and you develop it somewhere else independently, you may generate something patentable. Then go ahead. It's not tense. You can go ahead. Usually the discussion is such that it's both party, Penn and the student and the faculty, the inventors know, you know, what are the issues at stake here. It could be the best thing since sliced bread, but there's no room for the market to take it. And unfortunately, I wouldn't say we're always right. So for instance, we file on a method of use. A company developing the same compound for the same method is not infringing any issued IP until they get to market. Honestly, for the next 10 years, for instance, you accrue patent expenses, but you can't really sue the company for infringement. And then the next thing the company is going to do is challenge the IP. And challenging the IP nowadays becomes so easy. You did not file with USPTO on time, you know, 1 day delay, or the reporting's requirement where like you missed a week, or they find a paper somewhere that renders the invention obvious. There's so many ways that when we do have a method of use patent, you have to be extremely careful. Unless it's a method of use, but the party developing the drug is getting to the end of the life of the patent. They're also working in a very similar area, and they could see your new application as a way to expand the life of their asset, and they could leverage that. But it's creating a business solely on that is going to be very, very challenging. Unless it's a breakthrough pediatric indication, you can find formulation You can have a new manufacturing something. You need to find an anchor so that investors are going to provide you, risking their money.
Of course. And maybe to close the episode, if you had any pieces of advice, general or IP related, to grad students or any trainees looking to dive into entrepreneurship or start a company, do you mind just sharing those?
Sure. Talk to your tech transfer. We are here to serve the Penn community. We don't have all the answers. We're not necessarily right all the time, but talk to them. Ask for entrepreneurs that have worked with the tech transfer. Ask for reference. Ask question about the process. Ask question about why do they determine it's not patentable. Be involved in the process, because the more involved you are, the more you're going to learn. And one is, the more it makes my job fun. And two, it's a process and a thinking process. So you may start from A, and then during the discussion, you end up by being at M and then Z. And it's like, oh, but here we could go, but A is not, it really is not going to work. So that discussion is going to, no matter what, be fruitful. And if nobody answers you, just insist. Because, I mean, we are swamped, everybody is swamped, but you deserve to have your answer. So knock on the door, talk to us.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing your expertise. I think IP is one of those things that is always seemingly very difficult to understand. So having an expert on board and on your side is incredibly valuable. So yeah, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to our discussion with Vivian Martin, Director of Perelman School of Medicine Licensing at the University of Pennsylvania. We hope that you've learned more about the basics of intellectual property in the life sciences, especially as it relates to research that grad students or postdocs do in the academic setting. In our next episode, we will be hearing about the process of raising capital from venture capitalists for your new life science company. We will be speaking with Diana Bernstein, Vice President at North Pond Ventures, a life science venture capital firm.